I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, a Delaware exhibit celebrates the contributions African Americans have made to the first state. First, Mayor Jim Kenney is making good on some campaign promises to the delight of a major Philadelphia union. WHYY's Tom McDonald explains.
Former Mayor Nutter instituted the brownout policy, which meant closing firehouses temporarily on a rotating basis to save money. Nearby fire stations were expected to cover for the browned-out firehouses. During his campaign, Mayor Jim Kenney vowed to end the controversial policy, and he's announced that he's officially made good on that promise.
I know firsthand the sacrifices that the firefighters and their families make to keep all of us safe every day. They do exemplary work under incredibly difficult conditions, as we were all reminded just a few weeks ago when they successfully tackled a four-alarm fire near Rittenhouse Square in freezing temperatures.
Acting Fire Commissioner Derek Sawyer is carrying out Kenny's edict, and he says an additional sore spot for the firefighters is being remedied.
There also won't be any forced rotations for 2016. That process ended at the end of December, along with brownouts.
Andy Thomas, who heads up the union representing firefighters, is happy the mayor kept his word.
The response times for fire engine companies and fire ladder companies, it makes it better. It's when you have a browned out company, you actually have to travel a longer distance, so there's always the potential for an accident, and we don't want to see our members or the public hurt in any manner.
Controller Alan Butkovitz did a study on the policy, and he complimented Kenny on his decision.
The new mayor and the new administration have demonstrated very quickly that they have a real understanding of the burdens and the risks facing our firefighters and facing the public who are in the line of attack.
What's more, Butkovitz says instead of saving the city money, the brownouts actually cost more money. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Hundreds of Pennsylvania inmates serving life sentences now have a shot at release after last month's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on juvenile lifers. Though, as WHYY's Bobby Allen notes, while everyone agrees that the decision should give certain prisoners new hearings, how exactly that will play out is being fiercely debated.
Pennsylvania has the dubious distinction of having 480 offenders serving life terms for crimes they committed as teens. That's more than any other state. Two reasons for this. One, a state law that says anyone of any age who commits felony murder will be charged as an adult. Secondly, a law that requires mandatory life imprisonment if convicted of first or second degree murder. But that's all changing for some inmates with the Supreme Court's January ruling that prisoners serving life for crimes committed as teens should be reevaluated.
I think everyone agrees that the United States Supreme Court's decision is the law of the land and must be implemented. The question is not that. The question is, how can it be implemented?
Bradley Bridge with the Defenders Association of Philadelphia says the way forward is uncertain. Should new hearings be heard in state or federal court? Should DAs and defenders agree to consolidate some of Philadelphia's 300 or so cases?
Absent that, we need to come up with 300 prosecutors, 300 judges, 300 defense attorneys, 300 expert witnesses to be able to do that, and that will cost hundreds of millions of dollars.
Former prosecutor Joe McGettigan says some lifers still haven't paid their debt to society.
The person they killed is long since dead, turned to dust, and they're not getting another chance.
He says the court decision overlooks family members of victims who may still be grieving.
Nor does it take into as great a concern, I think, the interest of the state in protecting its citizens.
Pennsylvania's Department of Corrections spokeswoman Susan McNaughton says many of the state's juvenile lifers, some now in their 50s and 60s, have gone through rehabilitation to help them transition to a changed world.
We're going to teach them about computers. We're going to teach them about, you know, how gas pumps work and cell phones. You know, a lot of these people have been in prison possibly for decades and haven't had any experience with those things.
But it could take many more months until local and federal courts agree on how to interpret the Supreme Court ruling and then shake hands on where these hearings are going to happen. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf announced a plan this week to dramatically boost education funding. You can excuse school districts if they're a little skeptical they'll ever see the increase. They're still waiting for a full year's funding for the current year, never mind a boost. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports on the growing frustration as schools fill the gap by picking from an array of bad options.
How to pay for education is at the heart of snarling Pennsylvania budget negotiations that have dragged through spring, summer, fall, and into winter. Tuesday, Governor Tom Wolf announced he wants to increase education spending by $200 million next year, continuing an effort to restore school funding that dropped precipitously in 2011. Some places hit hard by those cuts are now just holding on, with the added challenge of not knowing when they'll get their money or how much. Places like blue-collar Morrisville School District in Bucks County. Mike Braun is the business manager there.
Costs go up all over the place. You have retirement, Social Security, and your medical benefits. They've all gone up.
Meanwhile, funding has stayed flat statewide. He says after the funding dropped, the district had to cut back on classes like art and even science. Without knowing what money will come from the state this year, Braun says his classrooms are going to continue to make do with fewer teachers in order to cover mandated costs like pensions.
So the bottom line is that you sacrifice other places of the budget in order to do it.
Morrisville gets about a quarter of its funds from the state. Many other districts in the Commonwealth get more than half of their funds from state coffers. The Reading Area School District, for example, gets 73% from the Commonwealth. Superintendent Khalid Mooman says the district is filling that hole with loans.
Right now, we're at a point where we're paying $800 a day in interest on a $20 million loan.
He says even with the loan, Reading schools are struggling to stay afloat. With no budget, there's no guarantee they'll get that interest covered by the state when there finally is a spending plan.
Thus far, knock on wood here, we don't have a great emergency right now, but the money's going to run out.
Even school districts that get just a smattering of their funding from the state are frustrated. Joe Cerisi is the school board chair for the Spring Ford School District, which bridges Montgomery and Chester counties. It gets less than 20% of its annual budget from Harrisburg. He says raising taxes is an option that many districts have taken, but one he's not willing to consider just yet.
So we've really got to look and say, okay, where can we trim? Because you can't go back to the taxpayers and say you're going to raise taxes 5% to make up because the state didn't give us anything.
What do those trims look like? It can mean choosing between calculators for students to use on statewide tests and new textbooks, or it could mean putting off much-needed building repairs. For how long, nobody knows. While it doesn't look like any districts will have to shut their doors yet, some districts in western Pennsylvania have considered not opening in protest. Brad Furco is the superintendent of the Sharpsville Area School District, which touches the Ohio border.
My suggestion was that we all cancel the first Friday night football game. I truly believe that that would be noticed by more people than some other thing.
Sharpsville is a rural district that gets more than half of its funds from the state. The bottom line, say superintendents across the Commonwealth, is that uncertainty means they'll be spending very, very conservatively until there is a budget, any budget, from the state. At the end of 2015, Governor Wolf released partial funding. The payments amount to about half of what was promised in an alternative plan crafted by Republicans. Nathan Maines, executive director of the Pennsylvania School Boards Association, says predictions are dire for when a completed budget would deliver on the rest of that tab.
I've heard, you know, April, I've heard sometime during the summer, I've heard maybe a few pessimists say that this is something that they could see not happening until after the November election, which would just be absolutely devastating to public schools.
In the meantime, schools keep plugging away because they have to. Furco from Sharpsville says just because schools can function shouldn't be taken as a sign that they aren't in serious trouble.
The message that needs to be sent is no, public schools aren't doing okay. We've been trained to say to the public, yeah, we're going to do all right. We're going to make it. We're going to be okay. But you know what? We're not.
Harrisburg keeps putting off a final decision, he says, but schools have to come up with plans to keep their doors open now. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, the state of Pennsylvania is eliminating those registration stickers that motorists put on their license plates starting next year. Now, to be clear, drivers will still need to renew their registrations and have vehicles inspected. The state transportation department anticipates the change will save more than $3 million in production and mailing costs. Those savings, in turn, will be used to purchase automated license plate readers, allowing police to scan license plates to see if the vehicle is registered and has insurance. The number of students sickened by a mystery illness at Ursinus College has risen to close to 200. A spokesperson for the college says 174 students have shown signs of a stomach infection. Overnight, two students went to the emergency room. Two others were taken to a hospital this morning. The school has closed its cafeterias and snack bar after students began complaining of vomiting, diarrhea, and stomach pain Tuesday night. Classes remain open, but weekend events have been canceled. Ursinus is continuing to work with Montgomery County health authorities to try to determine whether the ailment is foodborne or transmitted person to person. Mostly clear skies, 25 degrees at 6:15. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. Tonight's call, clear and cold, low 16 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny, high 27. To the weekend, Saturday, intervals of sun and clouds, a chance of scattered snow flurries, high only 19 degrees. A windy day will make it feel colder still, and then down to 2 degrees above zero overnight. Sunday, sunny, high 16. This is WHYY. Still ahead, it's a skater's delight as Philly lifts its skateboarding ban at Love Park before renovations start.
It's not just about Love being open for 5 days. It's about this administration kind of embracing some new thinking about civic planning, about placemaking for young people.
We'll attempt an axle stall when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The Supreme Court weighed in on clean air rules the other day, but the justices aren't the ones making the power.
It's not like take your furnace and put it on steroids. You're trying to heat your house. We're trying to take care of 2 million homes.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How power plants are warming up to new clean energy regulations. That's next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in Project Impact, a research study at Drexel University. This weight loss program is designed to help adults lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings included. Project Impact is funded by the National Institutes of Health. Details at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-553-7110. Drexel University supports WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The primary election process works to reduce the roster of presidential candidates. By contrast, there's an open invitation to attend headed to the White House from the campaign trail to Inauguration Day. It's a new exhibit opening tomorrow at the National Constitution Center on Independence Mall. Joining me with more is the center's exhibits developer, Sarah Winsky. Sarah, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Who's this exhibit for?
This exhibit is for everyone. I mean, we often say in the exhibit world, we're going for 8 to 80. You know, we're trying to get everybody who's interested in learning about history and the Constitution interested in this exhibit. But I will say in particular, when we created this exhibit, we were really thinking about middle school and high school students and groups because, you know, as they're learning about the election process a lot for the first time or maybe the second time in school or seeing all this happening for the first or second time in their life that they can really remember. We really wanted to break down the process for them and teach them a lot about what is actually going on around them, the history behind it.
And what are some of the challenges to making history fun?
There's a lot of challenges. I mean, especially now that everybody has smartphones with touchscreens, they're not as amused by touchscreen interactives as people used to be. We actually find a lot of what we would say is a low-tech interactive are really engaging. So today we were in there with a group of school kids who are our first visitors, and they immediately ran over to this table where they can make their own campaign stickers. There's also a wall we have where you can practice your presidential handshake. Anything they can move around, do, see, that's more the novelty now than actually having digital and media.
Interesting. What's old is new again. Low tech.
Exactly. Low tech things is sometimes the things that just completely sell it.
Also, what's old is new are the three specific elections that the exhibit highlights in terms of being transformative. The first one goes all the way back to 1840.
It does. 1840 is considered by historians the first modern campaign. You really had two well-formed political parties, the Democrats and not the Republicans. They was actually the Whigs before the Republican Party existed. Very organized, going going out to the public with parades and songs and slogans and really campaigning for their two candidates in a way that hadn't quite happened before.
And there's a Philadelphia connection to that election. Tell us about the distiller, Edmund Booz.
Edmund Booz. So William Henry Harrison, who actually ends up winning the election, he was actually from a very well-off Virginian political family, but he tried to put himself out there as a man of the common people. So one of the things they did is they used to say he grew up in a log cabin. He really didn't, but he would say that. So they made log cabin-shaped bottles that they would give out whiskey and hard cider to the people. And one of the distillers who was making these bottles was named Edmund Booz from Philadelphia. And that's where we get the word Booz from, is from his last name, and these log cabin-shaped liquor bottles. And we have one of the bottles in our exhibition as an artifact that you can actually see.
We haven't yet discussed Article 2 of the Constitution.
We haven't. Oh, so obviously in this exhibit, I mean, with every exhibit we do, we're always trying to tell about American history through the lens of the Constitution. And the presidency is covered in Article 2, which interestingly isn't that long. I mean, the Constitution itself isn't that long, but it's much, much shorter than Article 1 that covers the Congress. In the first section of Article 2, there's a lot about elections, but not that much. Not everything we do today regarding elections is in that Article 2. There's a lot that's been developed at the state level, with the parties, through history, through tradition. So the exhibit is really about breaking down, you know, all the things that are in the Constitution, explaining those, explaining where they aren't in the Constitution, where there's history, where there's tradition, how we've added amendments to expand voting rights or other things about the presidency. So we really explore that throughout the exhibition.
In listening to your CEO, Jeff Rosen, in anticipation of this event, he said the best takeaway about Article 2 is it calls for an executive branch that's strong yet constrained.
Exactly. I mean, that was really what the founding fathers, when they were meeting that summer in 1787, one of three really major things they were concerned about was the presidency, because they hadn't had an executive under the Articles of Confederation before that. There wasn't a real executive to sort of rally and make all these laws and things effective, but they were also always in fear of the monarchy they had just overthrown, trying to find that balance of having power but not too much power. And at the time, Washington, you know, was just really that person that everyone could turn to in literally in the room with them and look at this person and said, he can be that person. And I think that really impacted how they shaped the presidency.
Sarah, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Sarah Winsky is the National Constitution Center's exhibits developer. Headed to the White House from the campaign trail to Inauguration Day opens tomorrow and runs through Election Day. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. And elsewhere in the museum world, Delaware's African American history will soon take center stage. This summer, the Delaware Historical Society will unveil its newest project, the Center for African American Heritage. WHYY's Nichelle Polston reports.
Dr. Constant Cooper, one of the Historical Society's researchers, says this has been a long-term project.
In the past few years, as we've been developing the Center for African American Heritage, we have been focusing on collecting materials relating to Delaware's African Americans.
Researcher Dr. Cheryl Gooch says the exhibit's two main themes, slavery in Delaware and the struggle for freedom, and Beyond Bondage, Breaking Down Barriers, will shed light on the vast contributions blacks have made in the first state.
This exhibit covers more than 300 years of our shared history in Delaware involving the African American experience.
Thanks to a grant from the City of Wilmington and collaboration with Delaware's African American community, what first started as an idea will become reality in the summer. Scott Lair, CEO of the Historical Society, hopes this exhibit will bring about a new appreciation for all of Delaware's history.
It's an important time for this organization, but more importantly, it's an opportunity for people to learn more about new chapters, newly presented chapters, In Delaware history, and to gain a better understanding of all the peoples who have contributed to the state and what it is today.
One of the highlights of the exhibit is a ribbon badge dating back to 1892 from the African American Social Club of Lewis, Delaware. It is believed it was worn during an Emancipation Day celebration. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Nichelle Polston, WHYY News.
The ban against skateboarding in Philadelphia's Love Park is being temporarily lifted by Mayor Jim Kenney. Next week, the park will be demolished as part of a planned renovation. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that Love Park skateboarders can do their thing, but for just 5 days.
It's a coincidence that the small window of time when it's legal to skate in Love Park is also the coldest weekend of the winter. Temperatures are expected to stay in the single digits, but that does not stop longtime skaters.
A monumental place for me coming up in my youth and my teenage years and stuff like that. I was here every single day with these guys. You know, everybody has a story, and this place is a crucial part of my story.
That is Jared. He didn't want to use his last name because he's not a kid anymore. He's 38. He has a job and a baby. His quasi-legal hobby could jeopardize that. It's been illegal to skate in Love Park for 15 years now, and that still carries a sting. Tony Montgomery has spent much of the last 15 years getting chased out of the park by police.
Yeah, cops always harass you just for trying to do what you love to do. It's kind of bittersweet these days right now. This place isn't going to be around.
Despite the risks, Love Park is still a legendary skateboarding spot because of its unique arrangement of concrete steps and granite ledges. It's been featured in countless magazines, skateboarding videos, and video games. Aaron Grisham and his friends drove up from Virginia just so they could experience Love before it disappears forever.
Skateboarding is just like a big deal to us. It's like something we do pretty much every day. And, we always see it in, like, skate videos and stuff, and skate videos are a big deal to us.
The park's last hurrah is due to the efforts of Jesse Rendell. That's the son of former Mayor Ed Rendell and the board president of Franklin's Payne Skate Park Fund. That's a nonprofit that develops skate parks throughout the city. He lobbied the new mayor, Jim Kenney, to toss a bone to skaters around the world.
We knew that they were going to close it, and I just thought, look, if they're going to close this thing down and they're going to literally rip it out, what's the harm in letting people skate it for a couple days, you know?
Skaters from around the world are coming this weekend, some by the invitation of Nike, the athletic shoe company. Others are being lured by a $5,000 prize for the best trick caught on video, offered by The Barracks, a skateboarding website. Relaxing the ban for 5 days may seem like a small gesture from City Hall, but to Josh Nims, the founder of the Franklin's Payne Fund, it's actually a big deal.
It's not just about Love being open for 5 days. It's about this administration kind of embracing some new thinking about civic planning, about placemaking for young people. It sort of feels like there's an administration that may be ready to take that to the next level.
Nims hopes this gesture will pave the way toward more opportunities to develop youth recreational facilities and programs in Philadelphia. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, in a battle between a man's beard and Pennsylvania's budget impasse, the beard threw in the towel. Nearly 8 months ago, a Pennsylvania photojournalist vowed not to shave until Harrisburg passed a budget, resulting in more facial hair than anticipated. But after 224 days of growth, ABC 27's Eric Heisler announced he would be shaving off the budget beard. In an online press release, he compares his overgrown beard to the tangled mess of the budget impasse, saying, however, that the time has come to bid adieu to the beard since, quote, there's no visible end in sight. He's posted a video depicting the beard's beginning and its demise on Twitter at Heisler_Eric. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tomorrow, we'll continue our series, Every Zip Philadelphia, with a visit to 19107, which includes Chinatown. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.